Lewis Carroll, who wrote Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, loved riddles. Lewis Carroll was a mathematician, and he liked the way that riddles could reach a very silly conclusion from an odd question. He inserted several riddles into his books, including that scene where Alice stumbles on the Mad Tea Party with the Mad Hatter and the March Hare and the Dormouse. The Mad Hatter throws out a riddle for Alice. Why is a raven like a writing desk? And when you read this, you look forward to the punchline, which you expect to have some clever and surreal twist in it. But it never comes. Lewis Carroll just lets the riddle hang there. Alice, who had been looking forward to some fun, was very annoyed, and so were Lewis Carroll's readers. They wrote to him demanding that he come up with an answer to why a raven is like a writing desk, and so he did. But it's not for me to give you the answer here, now, not right now. I'm going to leave that for David Astle to answer in the course of today's show. David is, not to put too fine a point on it, a cruciverbalist, a man who creates crosswords, both quick and cryptic, for the Sydney Morning Herald, where he's known to his legion of fans as DA. David's book on riddles is simply called Riddledom. Welcome back, Dave.
I think you've just done a Carol. You've left the everybody hanging.
Yes, I have deliberately said it's a really cheap trick. It's a really cheap trick, but that's the pleasure of it, isn't it? I mean, you've done that in your book too. You like to let it hang, and then you come back to it, and it's fun when you do.
It's all about teasing. Riddles are the original teasers. And they tantalise, and then there is the payoff, and the payoff is the satisfaction or the reveal or the new wonderment, or a different way of seeing something. So we could defend that Lewis Carroll was playing the same game, but a riddle is also a covenant, and part of that covenant is that every question must have an answer. So he reneged on his compact with the reader.
Which is why they were so angry. Now, you are a wordsmith, of course, so what about the word riddle itself? Mm-hmm. Where does that come from?
Well, interestingly, there are riddles in industrial design that are sieves. Riddles are used in winnowing. Riddles are used in also in gold panning. And that is from the word riddle, which is to sift, the German word.
Oh.
But it is not, as many people would presume, the word that gives us riddle, as in the enigma. That is from Old English, which is riddles, R-A-E-D-E-L-S, which is to read. It gives us the word read, to interpret, to ponder. And so, therefore, the riddles is the source of riddle, but the other sifting idea is also very closely a close cousin and almost a fluky cousin, because riddles are also about sifting.
Do you know, I'm so familiar with that phrase, of course, that such and such was riddled with bullets. Yes. Without ever thinking too hard about it. But of course, it's being made sieve-like, I suppose.
Made sieve-like, that's right. It is a separate family, but it's just one of those beautiful linguistic flukes that sifting is very close to the interpreting and reading that you need to do to decode a tricky question.
I used to have a riddle book when I was a kid, and I remember most of the riddles still in there. I don't know why. Because you memorise them so you can tease them with your friends.
You
know?
Do.
Like, what's green and hairy and goes up and down? A gooseberry and a lift. You know, that stuff. That's what I got as a kid. Did you have something similar when you were a child,
Darwin? Look, I was that annoying child in the back seat who was continually just asking questions. And so my parents thought, what about if we give this precocious little brat a book that is full of riddles, and he may read, interpret, and might go away for a little while. But you're quite right, as you just foreshadowed, I did memorise them all. And so held court for pretty much the whole road trip to Uluru and back with my family, thinking, why did we ever give him a book called 1001 Riddles? Not just 100, 200, 1,001. And I did have them all down pat.
Halfway to all of you, your mother and I are trying to have a conversation at this point. So.
Yeah. There I am saying, why is the letter B like fire, Dad? Please tell me and put me out of my misery. Because it makes oil boil. We're nearly there. We're nearly there. They were all as bad as that too.
The Riddler in Batman comes from... I've often, big comic reader as a kid, mm-hmm. It always struck me that the Riddler had to be some kind of offshoot of the Joker. You know, the Joker is the first villain of Batman.
Yes.
And then there's the Riddler. And I think in between the two, you find the difference between a joke and a riddle. Like, the Joker is mad.
The Joker
is perfectly absurd. But the Riddler always sticks to a kind of tortured logic. How do you see the difference between a joke and a riddle?
It's a good distinction, because what the Joker was a psychopath, whereas the Riddler, while he had psychopathic tendencies, no doubt about it, there was also this perverse empathy that he had, almost pity for the Crusaders. And what he would do is he would torture them with riddles that did have answers, but the answers were so slippery and elusive that Batman and Robin were often just, you know, that 5 seconds or, you know, one block too late to the scene of the crime. So there was a beautiful logic in the Riddler's nefarious works, and it's really why I fell in love with riddles.
Now, last time you were here, I played you a riddle from the Riddler. I'm going to do it once again.
Oh, thank you.
Batman speaking.
Riddle me this. There are three men in a boat with 4 cigarettes, but no matches. How do they manage to smoke?
Okay, now there's the Riddler on the bat phone. Somehow he's got an hold of the bat phone.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Three men in a boat without matches. How do they manage to smoke? And eventually, of course, the boy wonder figures it out. Uh-huh.
There were three men in a boat with 4 cigarettes and no matches. How did they manage to smoke? They threw 1 cigarette overboard and made the boat a cigarette lighter.
Out-riddled.
Out-riddled.
Damn you, Riddle.
Curse you, Riddler. Yes.
Well, it's a lovely answer, because it's so logical and yet it's also so absurd. I mean, where is this cigarette lighter that you've just created? It's all in the pun and therefore does not exist. But in that beautiful riddle logic, it's there.
Does a riddle have a structure you've been able to discern?
Look, it's very hard to actually come up with a universal structure or a template that all riddles obey. But the two sort of leading criteria that I had entering into riddledom was that the question needed to be evasive. A question is something that seeks something out and doesn't necessarily know the answer. So if I'm saying to you, what time do you finish work today? That's not a riddle. I'm actually seeking information. Whereas if I play around with what does a hungry watch do, it goes back 4 seconds. See, that is a tricky question, and it has a prescribed answer, a preloaded answer. So while both are dealing with time, one is starting from a point of ignorance, the other is starting from a point of playful power. So it has, there's an evasiveness in the question, and there is a preloaded answer. They were the kind of two sort of beacons that I carried walking off into the dark.
So there's authority in that question. It's a rhetorical question, I suppose. No, it's not the same thing as a rhetorical question.
No, the rhetorical question is more a rhetorical device. It's about asking something that has no prescribed answer. This is more about, in fact, power is very important. It's why I think riddles are so addictive to children, because it gives them a chance to break that adult circle and also wield power within that circle, despite the questions being as corny as they often are, because it gives you the role of not just the orator suddenly, but also the umpire with the answer.
So you say the most important element in it is something called the block. What is the block?
The block, the Greeks knew it as aporia, which is a lovely word. It's, we know what portals are, and this is a lack of portal. So the question would seem to have no doorway, no point of entry. Or every entry you try, the lock rattles. You can't get through. And we've, in Anglo literature and Anglo, study, that's called the block. And it's where you are asked a question like, where does an Eskimo go to the toilet? And you're thinking, I suppose he just don't. It seems such an obvious question. Why is this such a difficult question? Where do I think? What's next? And when I say the answer is an igloo, are you thinking, okay, well, look, there's a curveball in the question, and there's a kind of boom tish in the answer. I apologize. There's going to be a lot more of these corny questions coming your way.
Yeah, there is something that sort of pleases you, but also makes you want to strangle the Riddler in this case, isn't there?
Well, probably a better example would be to ask a question that is just, it seems absurd. Like even the Raven and the Writing Desk, yes. If we can bring it back to that, that's a classic block, because there would seem no obvious connection at all. You might say both have legs. As Aldous Huxley suggested, neither have the letter B. So you are desperate to try and answer. But this is the beauty of riddles as well. It incites imagination. It incites creative thinking. It's okay to fail. If you don't know what the chemical symbol for copper is, that's okay. But just have a go what you think, where you think an Eskimo may relieve himself.
Well, how far back have you been able to trace a riddle in the history of civilization.
This is the phenomenal thing. I mean, I thought riddles. I thought Oedipus Rex was probably the riddle, the beginning. But Oedipus Rex was only sort of 300 BC.
And which riddle is that?
That's the riddle that is what is born with four legs has two legs by noon and three legs in the evening. And that's the classic riddle that Oedipus had to confront with the Sphinx. And if he could not solve it, he would lose his life. This is called a neck riddle, and neck riddles are a genre all to themselves.
Well, as in you're going to lose it.
You're going to lose your neck if you cannot answer this riddle.
And of course the answer to that was a man, wasn't it?
It was man because, that's right, born on all fours as we crawl around the house. Then we mature and become a biped through our adult life. And as the autumn of our years creep in, we rely on a walking stick. The three legs.
So riddles go back further than Oedipus Rex?
Way back further. In fact, I traced it to 7 millennia back, the oldest riddle that I found, and that is the riddle at least that was we've got a written record of, was from Sumeria on the Euphrates River, where an archaeologist came across these tablets that were put together in cuneiform by a child. And they were a writing exercise for a school, and they were all riddles. It was 24 riddles had been preserved in clay. And when you're asking about, you know, how to come up with a kind of template for riddles, a universal template, it's very difficult when you look at a riddle like this because it's all written in this elegant cuneiform, but the answer and the format remain quite baffling.
Right, and these are like students' riddles, are they? They're about the classroom of a kind?
I think they're more writing exercises. That's what's been suggested. But the riddle that drew my attention is the one that has baffled most scholars, and it all has to do with the word egaltar. And egaltar in Sumerian is an open house. And this particular open house is open, but it's closed. It sees, its eyes are open, but it does not see. And a lot of people have thought that it referred to a deaf person, because they would seem as though they are hearing your message, but in fact there's a communication failure. But a scholar by the name his name eludes me, Finkel from UK, he came up with this, I think, a very convincing theory, that egaltar, that is open house, is also the word that is used for someone who is a learner. So that is, they are open to learn. But if that house is closed, then that is interpreted as being a reluctant learner, someone who's not prepared to hear what you are saying. So it's this beautiful idea. It's got nothing to do with a deaf person, but in fact, you know, what a lovely, you know, concept that the original riddle that I could find has all to do with the inability to understand.
So I am open, but I am closed. It's like a lazy student in that sense.
It's when people, and we often do this, we often hear what people are saying, but we don't listen. Interviewing is the art of active listening, and I think learning is the art of active hearing.
There are riddles all over the world. This is the thing I learned from your book. Lithuania has riddles embedded into its vegetables, it seems.
They love their veggies over there in Lithuania. I can only presume that they're a very healthy race. So many of the riddles, that's what was so fascinating, parachuting into different cultures and seeing what topics preoccupied what cultures. And there's no doubt that in the case of the Lithuanian folklore, veggies were foremost. And, you know, in fact, Lithuania, I've been since reading, has been described as the great vegetable patch of Europe. It has perfect soil. And so consequently, you know, many of these riddles too arose from the working class. Folklore by nature is certainly oral and often in the hands of the workers. It's how you pass the day.
Yeah, I was noticing that a lot of the riddles seem to come out of cultures where, peasant cultures, where there's a lot of hard, repetitive labour day in and day out. And riddles are like a way of, I don't know, dressing up the landscape around you, making it more, helping the time go by, making everything more amusing. The same way like the British working class came up with rhyming slang to make everything more colourful, more interesting, have wordplay, reverse words, all that sort of stuff to make an otherwise miserable existence more palatable.
They spritz the lukewarm water of the working day. They actually give you the bubble. They give you the laugh. They give you the levity. They also make you... the original workers' riddles were the Brazilian slaves who were basically kidnapped from Africa, from Gabon and Angola, by Brazilian landowners and put to work in the coffee plantations of Brazil. This was in the 1500s. And these Brazilian slaves had to preserve their culture and their sanity through song. And so working all day, just digging the furrows, they had this beautiful call and response songs called pontos, which is the Portuguese word for knot, K-N-O-T. And the reason that they're called pontos is because they're riddle songs. And not only were they playful and, in fact, quite derisive of their bosses, but they were also a beautiful rhythm by which they worked.
I can see that in all kinds of slave cultures that bubble up into the mainstream. As you were saying that, I was just thinking of a great Bessie Smith song, a great jazz singer from the 1920s, who had a song title that was a riddle in itself, which was, "If I can't sell it, I'll keep sitting on it until I gives it away." I mean, isn't that a perfect riddle in its own? And when you realise what the answer is, it's quite amusing. Yeah.
Well, in fact, this is here we are, Brazilian slaves, 1500, and really the precursor to a lot of those beautiful working songs, slave songs, and gospel songs, ultimately in the American South.
Tell me about the riddle, that lovely riddle about the moon and the banana tree you found in Madagascar.
Madagascar is another really rich cradle of riddles. They have a thing called Haiteni, which is what they call sort of metaphor language. And this is the other power of riddles, is that it actually makes you think in terms of allegory. It enables a child with poetry. If in Africa, for example, in Bantu culture, they will describe a dove as being a lazy wife. In Madagascar, they might describe a waterfall as being a falling grandmother because it roars. It roars in pain as it's coming over the rocks. So to look at a waterfall and think of your grandmother,
yeah,
is suddenly creating all sorts of subtextual things in your mind.
Things aren't good at home, are they?
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
But true to their nature, the Madagascans have actually built a creation myth around a riddle because riddles and metaphorical and playful language are so vital to that culture.
What, like an Adam and Eve story?
It's their own Adam and Eve story, and the original couple, man and woman in the sort of Garden of Paradise, were confronted with a dilemma that seemed to make no sense. It was blocked. It had an illogic built into it. The deity asked, "Do you want, what would you rather, to die like the moon or to die like a banana tree?" Now, that seems as though it's a Hobson's choice. You know, ultimately, we're going to die. How would you wish to die? You know, like a moon or like a tree? And they opted to die like a banana tree. And then when they realized the consequence of that decision, which was, if they have chosen to die like the moon, they would have been immortal. Because the moon, while it dies, it also waxes into new life. So they would have chosen immortality. However, by choosing the banana tree, what they chose is a generation of children and generations of children. Because the moon is sterile, and while the banana tree dies, its seeds become the next tree. So while they passed up on immortality, they chose the richness and futurity of children.
That is incredibly moving and poetic. It's a beautiful story.
And that's just one of the wonders that I found lurking and that go by the name of riddles.
So where's the gag? They die. That's the gag, is it?
Well, this is it. We've got such a Western prejudice when it comes to riddles. We think of Christmas crackers. We think of, you know, little smutty things told at the back of the classroom or the bus. But while they're very important, you know, because they actually, you know, allow us to vent our emotions and to sort of paint lurid images, it's just as important to understand where we come from, which is a riddle in itself.
Japan is a country obsessed with riddles, and they have a game show directed to this called Shoten or something like that.
Yes.
How does that work?
It's an amazing game show. I've seen it only on YouTube, but I'd love to see it in full, where they have these cushions, and everyone on the show is entitled to win cushions. And the way you win cushions on Shoten is through the Nazakake riddle. And the Nazakake is the word for a comparison riddle. So I might say to you, what is the difference between an umbrella and a microphone? There's not necessarily a prescribed answer. I'm testing your creativity.
Oh.
What could it be?
I don't know. I just don't have that kind of agility, mental agility, I don't think.
Look, that's how the show operates.
Right.
They throw riddles at each other, and if they come up with a satisfying answer, a beautiful comparison, let's say that microphones and umbrellas, they both radiate. So in other words, one radiates outward to protect from rain and one radiates sound to reach a home. Now, if the audience, for whatever reason, thought that was droll, then I would be awarded a cushion. If they thought it was subpar, I would lose a cushion. And the winner is the person sitting on the highest stack of cushions, and they are the Nazakake master on Shoten.
Yeah, but surely there's got to be a payoff the other way. What happens when you lose your cushions, though?
Yeah, that's right. If you become cushionless and you, at the end of the day, after all these riddle solving, you still can't win the favour of the crowd. In true Japanese game show style, you then go through these ordeals of debasement. Yeah. Where it's basically a riddle-off.
Right.
So the two with the least number of cushions have this riddle, one-to-one riddles, and whoever the crowd votes for, the loser then has to sort of eat a scorpion or kind of subject themselves to some kind of impossible torture.
Well, it's a whole culture of its own, isn't it? The Japanese game show meeting riddles is a wonderful thing.
The other thing that we've touched on here is that the idea of humility and embarrassment, which is also really important. So many riddles in so many cultures, there's a nasty consequence if you don't answer the riddle.
Ah, and that brings us to Rumpelstiltskin. There are riddles embedded in Brothers Grimm's fairy tales, and most of us know Rumpelstiltskin, but the thing is, we know the answer to the riddle.
Yes.
That Rumpelstiltskin is his name, so I'm not giving anything away here. There's no, the payoff is already kind of known, but she doesn't know. But there's another Brothers Grimm fairy tale that's called The Riddle. Tell that story, please.
Yes, it's okay. We all tucked up in bed.
All right.
We're comfy. This is the story called The Riddle. One day there was a handsome prince who was riding through the forest with his servant, and he came across a cottage, and looking for shelter, he went inside, and there was an old woman. But what he didn't know was that this old woman was a witch and was trying to poison the handsome prince. The handsome prince, who was not suspicious, put his cup down near a window, didn't realise that his faithful horse put his head through the window and licked the drink. And being full of poison, the horse died. When the prince's servant saw this, he then noticed that a raven came and lit upon the horse and started pecking at the horse. The servant shot the raven with his bow and arrow, and the raven died and was then the likely supper for the prince and his assistant at the tavern where they next arrived. The servant took the raven to the kitchen and asked for it to be prepared. There just so happened to be in this tavern 10 guests who were all villainous murderers. It's a terrible place, this grim Germany. And these murderers then seized upon this raven, because it was the only repast available in this forest, and shared the raven amongst the 10 of them. The 10 died, and the prince and his servant escaped with their own lives, having escaped the prince, the witch, through just sheer coincidence and luck, and now escaping the tavern. Finally, after much travail, they reach a beautiful kingdom where a princess reigns supreme. And this princess is a lover of riddles. And she says, whoever can ask me a riddle that I cannot solve will be my husband. However, if I can solve that riddle, I will take that man's head. So again, the big payoff. What happens is, and this is a beautiful idea of riddling, if you want someone not to solve your riddle, you draw on a unique experience that, just like Rumpelstiltskin happens, where the askee, the hearer, the solver, doesn't know that experience. So this is what the prince does. His riddle is, though I kill none, I kill seven. I kill 12.
Though I kill none, I kill 12.
Yes. And the princess has no idea what this riddle might be. So what she does then, she has 3 days to solve the riddle. She dispatches all these temptresses into the princess's room and tries to inveigle the answer from the prince. What could the answer be? What could kill none and yet kill 12? Because the raven, let's not forget, didn't kill anyone. It was shot by the servant. Then the raven's poisoned meat went on to kill the 12 murderers. And that is the grim answer to the grim Das Rätsel riddle. However, when the princess has to solve it, she realises that she cannot. And then, consequently, prince and princess are beautifully married, all due to a poisoned raven and 12 murderers and a witch. And it really sums up that idea of love, turning point. A riddle is the great capsizer. It actually turns what it gives you this massive narrative switch, which is the seduction and the allure of riddles.
It turns over everything in your mind. Everything you think you know about this is wrong. That's wonderful. Though I killed none, I killed 12. And it's the Raven. That's brilliant.
On air, online, and on your mobile, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
I'm with David Astle, cruciverbalist, puzzle master, a man who loves wordplay and riddles. He's written a book on riddles called Riddledom. And he's also got a kid's book out called Wordburger. Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, she stumbles on the Mad Hatter's tea party and the Mad Hatter throws it out to her. He says, why is a raven like a writing desk? And you remember how Alice responds? She gets all excited, doesn't she?
She does. Yeah, sure. This is this is what kids love. The play of language and then the payoff.
Because the conversation so far with the Mad Hatter has been rather irritating for her.
Rather mad.
Rather mad, indeed. So she goes, oh, goody, all right, okay, why is a raven like a writing desk? And his response is...
Well, he'd moved on. It was, that's old news, he said, because he was talking about other topics. I suppose Lewis Carroll played it beautifully by emphasising the fact that the Hatter was mad. And mad people don't necessarily honour protocol, which is what was happening on the page. But, of course, all the readers were in umbrage. You just can't do that. And Carroll acquiesced with his eventual answer that he published in the foreword of a future edition, which was, though they both produce notes, that is, a writing desk and a raven, though they are very flat.
Ah.
And then he added, and you never put the wrong end at the front. And all that didn't make a whole lot of sense, particularly that that second sentence. So this was it was a really interesting exercise in human psychology, because even though Carroll, you know, through his Hatter's character, provided the answer, people were still, you know, ticked off. It's as though, you know, the...
There's another riddle embedded in the answer, is there?
Yeah.
Well, I get they both produce notes, but they're even though they're flat, what was the other part?
You never put the wrong end at the front. And this is what's so fascinating. There was a Lewis Carroll scholar called Dennis Crutch in 1960 who was going through some old papers and came across Carroll's original handwriting to that question. And what he had done in, you know, pure cruciverbal sort of spirit, he wrote never, N-E-V-A-R. So you never put the wrong end at the front. In other words, you switch, you transpose the spelling of never to raven. It's an anagram. But an editor had presumed that he'd made a typo, a spelling mistake, and they corrected it to never, the correct spelling. So the painful pun was never realised. Crutch then sort of tried to redeem Carroll posthumously. But to this day, people were still really dissatisfied with that answer.
Oh, it's an anti-typo, I suppose.
Well, I suppose I did say the word typo, but of course it would have all been by quill or, you know, by cartridge pen. But the other thing that was interesting is that all these people, as we, you know, were alluding to earlier, had come forward, including Sam Lloyd, who was a famous American puzzle maker, who suggested that the connection between a raven and a writing desk is that... Edgar Allan Poe wrote on both. But, of course, that would seem to jar with Wonderland. Edgar Allan Poe did not exist in the Wonderland consciousness.
It's a little too correct or something. I don't know. It feels unsatisfying, that answer. Could anyone do any better than that?
This is the beauty of it. The wisdom of crowds were put to the work. That question was floating around chat rooms and all, you know, different websites and even became a competition on radio shows. Who can come up with a better answer for this riddle? And it was only recently, 2009 or 2010, in a chat room attached to io9, which is a website.
It's a tech website, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is a tech website. That someone who is, you know, not even identified, it was only by their sort of chat room handle of Mr. Gone, came up with the most elegant spoonerism, which is also beautiful because Spooner was a colleague of Carroll at Oxford. And that is that a raven is a pest for wrens and a writing desk is a rest for pens. And suddenly, the universe seemed to be back in alignment.
Oh, yes. That's a very satisfying answer, isn't it?
I think I can almost hear Lewis Carroll cheering from his casket.
Yes. So why is a raven like a writing desk? One is a pest for wrens. The other is a rest for pens.
Isn't that why riddles are also so delicious? It's because you may compose a question like the, you know, microphone and umbrella thing that I did earlier. And there will be someone out there who has a better answer. That is that they encourage you to come up with better answers, funnier answers, sharper answers. And that is a real spur to creative thinking that gets so many problems solved and inventions invented.
There's a riddle embedded in the tale of Solomon and Sheba. Can you please tell that story and the riddle that's embedded in it?
It is the classic seduction tale. And no wonder there's been so many movies made of this particular story, because these are the two potentates of the Western world. Of the Middle East, I should say. Solomon and Sheba were both sovereigns of their respective empires. And what Sheba was attempting to do by visiting Solomon's court was to inveigle him with riddles, to prove his wisdom. And if he failed to answer these riddles, he knew implicitly there would be dire consequences. Not only was she a beautiful woman who had all the seductive powers available to her, but she was also testing his ego and his wit. The other amazing thing about these two powerful figures is that there was much rumour going around Solomon's court that she was a witch, a genie. And the only way that you could prove this, according to Arabic folklore, is to have a look closely at her legs.
Why?
Because hairy legs, yes, listeners, hairy legs was the clear sign of a genie or a witch. No matter how often she tried to remove those hairs, it's almost like a reference to the sort of, you know, goat association of the devil.
I'm certain there's been about 100,000 feminist doctorates written on that. That just seems to be like absolutely right out there, doesn't it? Yeah, so what happens then?
Well, what Solomon does is he creates this special room for her to arrive in that has a glass floor. And it works twofold. Not only does it give him the chance to basically upskirt her, but also she presumes, as you know, by optical illusion, that it is a surface of water. So she rolls up her skirts, her lavish brocaded skirts, to ford the throne room to reach Solomon's audience.
And are her legs revealed to be hairy as well?
They are hairy.
They are.
So he knows that not only is he in front of a powerful woman, who has charms and also has challenges, but she also has the devil on her side.
Yeah, but sometimes a girl who's running affairs of state doesn't have time to shave her legs in the ancient world. I mean, that's...
Yes, that's spirit thought for Sheba here. Yeah, yeah. I think she gets a lot of bad press.
Yeah, indeed. So what's the riddle here?
Well, there are three riddles, and two of them are very complicated about sort of family trees. They're quite a bracken, but Solomon slices through each of these brackens with a sure, you know, axe-like blow of logic. But the one that many people dwell on, and for good reason, is almost like a numerical equation. It is 7 exit and 9 enter, 2 pour, P-O-U-R, and 1 drinks.
7 exit, did you say?
Yeah, 7 exit.
And 9 enter.
Mm-hmm.
2 pour.
That's right.
And 1 drinks.
Now, can you imagine the sexual, intellectual tension in the room? These two, you know, great sovereigns of their nations, of their empires. And Sheba thinks, I've got him. This riddle will give me the entire territories of this man just by him failing to match my wits. But Solomon, without missing a beat, so the record says, turns around and says, it is womanhood. And she goes, please explain. Thinking that he's just trying to get away with a cheap answer. And the idea is that 7 exit refers to menstruation. 9 enter, so it's the coming of the child. 2 pour, that's the 2 breasts. And 1 drinks, which is the newborn. So it's basically womanhood. And the beauty of that riddle is she knew full well that he had the wherewithal to possibly answer it, and even if he answered it correctly, it referred him directly to her power. that she was a beautiful woman standing in front of him with the potential to raise his young, with every asset known to womanhood.
Yeah, they're talking about her body.
They are talking about
so
her body.
So the riddle's a flirtation then?
It's a flirtation. And riddles are flirtation. They are seduction. They're tools of seduction.
Freud was interested in jokes.
For good reason.
For very good reason. Well, how about riddles? Clearly this would have rung a few, I don't know, alarm bells isn't quite the word, but it would have attracted his interest, surely.
It did. In fact, he wrote extensively about the joke and the subconscious. And it's because he saw riddles as being, you know, beautiful means of revealing pent emotion. What is laughter? To Freud, he thought laughter was basically the sudden release of trapped emotion. And what riddles in, you know, what they trigger are that very response, because they are inappropriate. They might be violent. They might be perverse. They might be contrary. And what is trapped inside us suddenly releases. So Freud became fascinated by riddles and jokes, and he classified them into three categories.
Yeah, there's the juxtaposition of incongruities, the two things that don't fit placed side by side, creates a kind of a paradox in the mind.
That's right.
Which makes you want fizz and explode, and it's lovely. It's a release from the kind of tiresome plod of logic, one thing after another, after another, after another.
Look, it's why there's so many cat videos and silly videos out there, because what they often are is you have this intellectual prefigurement of what is going to happen, and something different happens, and that is funny because there's a kind of intellectual tickling that happens. There's a kind of a logical arc that is breached, and that's one type of riddle. And the other is this, or one type of humour, according to Freud, and the other is the wit, which touches on that emotion that's trapped inside us. And the other that's important to remember is called das Humor, which is basically the joy of laughing, the kind of the rapture, just being totally immersed in whether it's silliness, whether it's just a sense of unity.
And yet there's something about the German language when you call it das Humor.
Das Auto.
I'm laughing at it, not with it, actually, to be honest. I have to say there is a kind of heaviness embedded in that. My favourite part, or the funniest part of your riddle book here, are the anti-riddles. I tried this on my 12-year-old daughter the other day. She's not really interested in her dad trying to be funny anymore.
Yeah.
But I called out a few to her, and she looked a bit perplexed on the first one and the second one, and then she burst out laughing on the third. Like, you know, what would Winston Churchill do if he were alive today? Scream and scratch at the coffin lid. How about this one? What did Grandma say to the frog? Something racist, probably. That's beautiful.
It is beautiful because they break the etiquette, and there's something very true about the answer.
Why did the circus close? A long, chilling list of animal rights violations.
They play gotcha. Like if I say to you what is a vampire's favourite sport, the answer could be lacrosse, or it could also be Gaelic football. But that's a riddle. But if I said to you what is a vampire's favourite cocktail, you're thinking, oh, it's going to be Bloody Mary. It's going to be, you know, what could it be? A rusty nail, maybe? No, you wouldn't like a nail. And then I'll say, well, vampires don't exist, which is really rude, but it's an anti-riddle because it's playing around with the, you know, presumption of we are suspending our realities here and having a game, and then bang, I'll breach it by coming in with reality.
Yeah, cruelty. There's so much humour in cruelty. Cruelty is a fabulous thing too. I think there's cruelty in most humour, actually, in a lot of humour. If it's going to really sting, if it's going to really make you bellow with inappropriate laughter. The knock-knock joke, is that a form of a riddle?
That fell into the anti-riddle category. Yeah, I broke the... To curate a book like this, I thought, well, there are, you know, it's so difficult to actually try and pigeonhole riddles. You know, is this a soulful riddle? Is it a seductive riddle? But anti-riddles were reasonably easy to identify. And I thought knock-knocks were a classic case of salient point, because the answer is provided by the asker. And that just seems to go against the basic rules. And it's interesting to look at where knock-knocks came from, and most likely it came from, at least popularised by the play that shall not be named, the Scottish play.
The Scottish tragedy?
The Scottish tragedy.
How is that a knock-knock? What?
Well, in fact, if you think back, I think it's Macduff and Macbeth Macduff certainly, who are just on the, after Duncan had been murdered, they arrive at the corridor and knocking on the castle gates, and a drunken porter is there.
Oh, yes, that's right. It's the only humorous scene in the play.
It's pretty much the only humorous scene. Yes. So it is, and he postulates who could be there. It's not the classical call and response bada bing that we know of the modern knock-knock, but it certainly plays around with the knock-knock and imagining who is at the door.
There's a couple of ones here I hadn't heard before. Knock-knock, who's there? Irish stew. Irish stew in the name of the law. And of course, you've avoided the classic interrupting cow one as well. You know, knock, knock, who's there, interrupting cow. Moo! which is wonderful. But again, there's a play there. There's a thing there. That I think there's a bit of music in a knock, knock joke because there's a certain kind of cadence to
let's,
the thing.
Let's do
that
it. Okay, I'll do one on you. Right. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Two.
To who?
No, it's to whom, Richard. I would have thought ABC broadcaster, you would have known that by now. It's cruelty, and it's there. It's just it's a shared silliness.
It certainly is. There's a lovely story about a strange philanthropist in the United States who was putting out clues, riddles, on a Twitter account called @HiddenCash, which sounds like a kind of, I don't know, FM Brekkie Show cash giveaway or thing. But what was this? Explain what this was.
Yeah, he was an anonymous donor, philanthropist, who had who'd made his money, all we knew from what he told us, was through real estate investment around the West Coast. And he wanted to give back to the community. And the way he did that was in very kind of, a little bit like Edward Nigma, that is the Joker. The Riddler from Batman. He posed these questions to the good people of California in the guise of a riddle. And the riddles might be something like, where might a robin and an eagle invest their money? And the answer to that is Burbank. That is Burbank. So they've got everyone then just suddenly swarmed upon Burbank. And he hid caches of cash all around parks and things like that. He would specify where it might be found.
And did this attract a frenzy of cash hunters?
It did. And there was, an infamous one was they are constantly hungry and need to be fed. And people were, trying to speculate what that could be. And they were, gate crashing the zoo. They were looking at pet stores. They were trying to work out. Then they thought it's babies. So then they visited every daycare center in California. And then when they realized that it was parking meters and he had hidden cash taped around to parking meters.
Oh, my God.
Always hungry and need to be fed. Every parking meter, from LA to San Francisco was rattled and rolled and, looked for extra cash. So he did create an absolute hysteria. And it just shows you, how acquisitive we can be, but also inquisitive when it comes to riddles.
The great Victorian historian Thomas Macaulay, who wrote some grand historical narratives, wrote this beautiful riddle in a poem, which is really very elegant and very, very nice. Tell me, first of all, though, the incidents that it came out of.
Look, it's a haunting story, Richard, because he was a poet and a writer and a historian, but he was also a great visionary when it came to education, and he spent a long time in the British India, setting up education networks and education system through the Raj. But then that all came to grief in the sort of 1870s or so when the Sikh mutiny occurred, and the Sikh mutiny was.
Sepoy or Sikh, was it?
Sepoy. Sepoy mutiny. It was a massive massive uprising. It all had to do with the Enfield rifle too, which is fascinating. Because the Enfield rifle is where you need to feed buckshot into the cartridge. You need to tear open the cartridge's wrapping, and the cartridge's wrapping was doused in tallow fat just to keep with the lubrication for the cartridge. And tallow fat, of course, is it's to a vegetarian is anathema. You can't do it. So, in fact, it was all to do with with tallow fat began these uprisings, and there were 40,000 people killed at Kanpur, and there were risings in Uttar Pradesh. It was Bihar, massive killings. So Thomas Macaulay was seeing his great vision come unstuck. And how did he try and distill and deal with this this heartbreak? He wrote a riddle, and it is just a really exquisite riddle. I'm tempted to almost give you the answer so you can appreciate the device that he's using. He realized that when he was looking at all this manslaughter, that if you just separate the sort of fourth letter, you know, if you separate that word, it becomes man's laughter. And that bitter irony was the sort of what underpinned his riddle.
Could you read the actual riddle itself?
Look, it's in verse form? Sure, it's in verse form, but bear in mind that the answer is manslaughter. So now that you know that, just listen to the play that is happening in light of this tragic event. Let us look at it quite closely. 'Tis a very ugly word, and one that makes one shudder whenever it is heard. But only see the consequence. That's all need be done to change this massive sadness to unmitigated fun. It clears off swords and pistols, revolvers, bowie knives, and all the horrid weapons by which men lose their lives. It wakens holier voices, and now joyfully is heard the native sound of gladness compressed into one word. Yes, 4 and 8, my friends, 4 and 8, let that be yours and mine. Though all the hosts of demons rejoice in 3 and 9. Man slaughter, not man's laughter.
Oh, that's beautiful, isn't it? That's elegant. And I wonder how long it took for people to spot the answer to the riddle.
Yeah, it was Macaulay's riddle. And I just think it's incredible that a man who basically would see so much bloodshed and so much kind of good works, you know, ruined, could turn around and compose himself to compose a verse that also embraces a beautiful little piece of verbal chicanery that, you know, I think it's ageless. It's a beautiful idea.
There's a riddle in Jane Austen's novel, Emma, where Emma is trying to get Mr. Elton, the young curate, to fall in love with her friend Harriet. And Mr. Elton writes a riddle. And because Emma is very clever, she figures it out, and it's about love. And she thinks it's directed to her friend Harriet, but in fact it's directed to her. So there's, again, the riddle is flirtation, but misdirected if it's not clearly perceived where it's coming from.
It's very, and in fact, there's a lovely, in Borneo, where riddles are used as arbitration. That is, if there's a kind of infraction within the village. In North Borneo, the Dusun people, they use riddles to affirm the culture. They sort of underline and emphasise the mores that you have just broken.
How so?
Well, let's say that you've, you know, in some vendetta with a neighbour, you've, you know, tore up some crops that you shouldn't have done. So I'll bring both of you, you and the other party, together in a tribunal, and I will ask you riddles. And these riddles, they actually are about the peace of the village around you. And it might be something like, I am a hardwood village that falls many. And the answer to that is a blow dart, because the hardwood bridge, which is also the same material that makes a blow dart, is about you remembering that if you have a conflict, that you need to sort of, you know, you don't need to apply the blow dart. You actually need to keep together as a village, because only in unity is strength.
Build a bridge and get over it, as we'd say, instead. I mean, that's lovely. So is it trying to tease people into a more generous mode of thought then?
It is. Well, in fact, what riddles do, and looking at all these riddles across all cultures, is that they're these little kind of sponges of culture. They capture what is important, what is sacred, what is holy, what is taboo within that culture. So they're not just flirtatious, you know, but they're also means of affirming identity. There are means of proving your courage. There are means of just thinking sideways.
And finally, anagrams. I know you're wonderful with anagrams. Of course, you have to be to set a cryptic crossword. The thing I like about anagrams, they are a riddle insofar as the riddle is to find the hidden meaning buried in the name. And once you do, it seems like fate, doesn't it? It's like you were born with this name, or someone has a name, and that's their fate hidden in their name.
Well, in fact, yeah, that's very true, because I love that... Lord Nelson is an anagram of, that is the actual name of Lord Nelson.
Horatio, Lord Horatio, yeah. Nelson, yes.
He's truly, he'll see war. His name was, what was his name?
Wellington. That's yeah. Wellington, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Yes. And James Stewart, you have there as a just master.
A just master?
Yes.
There were beautiful riddles that cropped up in puzzle form where they would play around with, it's called cognate riddles. So the war is an anagram of wreath. Or the law is an anagram of wealth. Huh. Or oh, sour hope is an anagram of poorhouse. And so it was this kind of puzzle play that made people realise just the secrets that were hiding inside words and what they could reveal.
I just have one more thing for you, David, which is something to give to you. It's a bit of verse as well from one of the greatest poets in the English language, which is Mr. A.A. Milne. You ready for this?
Yes.
Cottleston, Cottleston, Cottleston pie. A fly can't bird, but a bird can fly. Ask me a riddle, and I'll reply. Cottleston, Cottleston, Cottleston pie. How do you like that? You like that?
It's delicious.
Much. Yes, yes. Pooh Bear says that. And it's one of those things you discover once you have kids. You read them, you go, oh, this is marvellous, this stuff, isn't it? A fish can't whistle and neither can I was the other one of that.
Oh, yeah. Look, in fact, A.A. Milne was one of my first loves. I loved, you know, Winnie the Pooh would say, what day is it? And Ed Rabbit would say, it's today. And he goes, that's my favourite day.
Mine too. What a wonderful thing to have you back on the program, David. Please come back on anytime you like.
Absolutely.
Such
pleasure.
A pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.